Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. My name is John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. In this episode, we celebrate Minnesota author A. Raphael Johnson. He is the author of the novel The Through, which was a finalist for the 2018 Minnesota Book Award. You can read his fiction in publications such as African American Review, Spacecraft Project, Quelly Journal, and Callaloo. In this episode, I'll be reading his short story, Morrison's Note. But first, let's listen to my interview with Mr. Johnson, which took place on June 29th of this year. I'd like to welcome A. Raphael Johnson to the podcast.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day. I know how busy you are. Give us a little bit of background information about whatever you feel comfortable talking about.
Okay. My name is A. Raphael Johnson. I normally go by Andy Johnson, but when my novel was coming out, my publicist said, you know, the name Andy Johnson is really boring.
That's pretty cold.
So you're going to need something else. And so Raphael is actually my middle name. So that's my pen name. And yeah, I was born in New York State. I lived there and went to school there off and on in my childhood. I also grew up partially in Texas, went to college there in Austin and lived there for quite a while. I graduated with a bachelor's degree in drama from the University of Texas at Austin. I worked around Austin for quite a while, then later got a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing at the University of Alabama. I worked as a foreign aid worker for a bit and as a consultant, and now I live here in Minneapolis where I write, and I also co-own a consulting company.
Consulting on what?
We work with people who are trying to make a positive difference in the world in one way or another. So we help in a, you know, doing a variety of things, sometimes program evaluation, research, teaching, convening meetings, all sorts of stuff.
So it's like social services, education, you sort
something
of,
like that. Yeah.
Yeah. How long have you been doing that?
We've been running this particular company for about 2 years. We started just before the pandemic lockdown, so we're very happy we're still in business. Mm. But I've been consulting now for about, getting on 6 years now.
Yeah. What's the name of the company?
Inspire to Change.
Inspire to Change.
Inspire to Change.
And did you start it with grants? How did you get it off the ground?
No, it's a for-profit business, and we started it by, I mean, in the business, it's called bootstrapping. It means that people paid us for services, and we use that money to build the company. So we got some very small loans when we first started out, but we mainly survived by working with our clients.
And was this your idea, or did you go in on this with a partner? No,
This was a practice born from the collaboration that my wife and I have as consultants together. She's a university-trained evaluator, so she uses qualitative and quantitative methods essentially to figure out what people are doing and what's most effective. And I came in with a long background in the arts, and so the way I understand people was very different. And we realized that by putting our methods together, we came up with something really special and unique that we call creative evaluation and engagement. And that is, in a nutshell, that's how we started the company, by putting our methods together and then figuring out, like, what was the space where those services were needed? How do we explain what we do to people and stuff like that?
That's really fascinating. So your skill set kind of dovetailed with hers in a way that really worked for this concept for the company.
Correct. We are largely dependent on the funding that nonprofits get and, you know, what funding. We rarely work for government agencies. Sometimes we do, but we mostly work with nonprofits and foundations. And so, you know, what they're interested in varies quite a bit. Before the pandemic, we did a lot of work with arts and education. Post-pandemic, probably half of our work is in health equity. And so, yeah, you know, those priorities change. And so we've learned how to change with them.
And now you own your own business. So how does that work as far as finding time to do your writing? Owning your own business can mean that you're like always on the clock.
Is that an issue?
My alarm is set for 4:45 a.m. Wow. And that's when I can have a clear mind and no one is calling or texting and emails aren't coming in. And so I write very early in the morning. If I can, you know, if I can find some time at some other part of the day, I'll also write then. But yeah, the consistent time I get is from, I guess, about 5 to 7 or 8 a.m., depending on the day.
So you have really carved out in a dedicated way a very clear space for your art. That's pretty impressive, because I think that's hard for a lot of people to be that disciplined.
It's very hard. It's of all the things about writing, all the sort of the advice I've ever heard and the, you know, the practices and such, having consistent time to write, I think, is one of the most important. Not everybody can do that. And certainly when I was starting out, I could not do that. I just sort of wrote whenever I had a spare minute or a half hour or anything. But Walter Mosley talks about having a sort of waking dream that is your writing. And if you know you're going to write at a certain time every day, it's very easy to slip back into that dream. Whereas if you don't know what your schedule is, it can be easy to lose your waking dream, which is your writing. I don't know that that's true for every writer, but it is definitely true for me.
Consistency really is the key to a lot of things in life. So, and including being creative, I think. Were you always such a disciplined person, or did you have to learn that?
No. You know, I would say for most of my life until I started writing, I was pretty impulsive. I mean, I could be disciplined around, like, I've got a job and I got to be on time and things like that. But I was always wanting to try new things or do this or do that. And I would get into a project and just be very intensely in the project. And, you know, my background is in theater. And that's sort of what we do. We get very into something and then it's over. Writing is more of a marathon. So I've had to learn to just be, you know, a little slower and more consistent and not expect results in 3 months.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you went from being a performing arts person to writing. So just talk a little bit about your background. You have a fine arts degree in theater?
Correct. I have a Bachelor of Arts in theater.
And was it, and it was acting that you were focused on in that program?
Interestingly, initially, yes. I was very focused on acting. I wanted to be an actor. But then, you know, this was the late probably the early 90s, say like 1990, when I was pursuing this degree, it became very clear that at least in the department I was in, you know, it was majority white, it was a majority white institution, and they were very much into kitchen sink realism at the time. You know, these realistic situations, realistic families, and, you know, we can debate what realism is and how real it is, but at the time, that's what they wanted to do. And they were very clearly not about to cast me in any part that had not been specifically written for a Black actor. So when we're performing Chekhov or Sartre or, you know, any of those 20th century classics, I couldn't be cast as, you know, a central family member or something like that. They might cast me as like the neighbor or the friend or someone, some minor part. But I couldn't get a lead part no matter what I did. And so I dropped out of the acting program and focused on directing and stage management, which is where I felt I had more control over my artistic life.
So out of frustration, you moved out of acting into these other disciplines.
Yeah.
What a shame. I mean, that seems very short-sighted of them. It's hard to imagine in this day that was the thinking. But so, well, I mean, you had the presence of mind at least to figure out that wasn't going to work and move into something that you felt you would be able to make work because you had, as you said, you had more control. And isn't that what so much of life is about, finding ways to get your control back? And you've done that. You've got your own business, your writing, which you control in its entirety. So Yeah, well, I mean, yes, I hear that, and I understand where that comes from. So we'll talk more about that, where that response came from. Because, yeah, that is definitely, when I'm saying that you have control over it all in terms of the creation of the thing. But getting it out into the world is a whole different story, which I know is probably extremely frustrating. So let's talk about that. I'm just so fascinated by the acting part, because that's where I'm coming to all of this from. So, yeah. And I look at you and I see someone who I would have you play Big Daddy in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I think they've done all Black productions. This is the other thing. Then it becomes an all Black production, you know, which is like, that's solving one problem, but it's really not. It's not addressing the larger issue of things, you know? Well, you definitely have a look and a sound, and I could see you on stage, and you look like someone who would be formidable on a stage. So anything can happen in this life, you know, you never know. You may end up somewhere on a stage or on a film set one of these days, you know? but let's get back to the writings. The story that brought you to my attention is Morrison's Note. And that was so unlike anything that we had read. You know, the minute I read your story, I was like, we got to talk to A. Raphael. That is I used the word audacious, I think, when I was reaching out to you. You have an audacious sense of humor. And that, I mean that in the absolutely most complimentary way, because you take huge risks in your writing. You know, risks like that, you have to have some guts to take those kinds of risks. So just tell us a little bit about, you know, because it's not realism. And I know when you were talking about the theater, you know, being kind of stuck in this kitchen sink realism world, and I was about to say, I didn't want to interrupt you, but I was like, that is clearly, realism is not your thing, Andy, right? clearly not. So talk a little bit about this story, because it is out there. There are like multiple levels and layers of reality in this, right? Yeah. I would get deep into weeds that I couldn't get out of if I tried to talk about this story. So I want you to just, you know, give us a little bit of background about how it came into being, because it's so unique.
Okay. How did I write this story? Well, I think the sort of the kernel of it started when I took a class with Ricky Ducournay, who was a guest author at Alabama for a semester. And she gave us all individual book recommendations. And the book she recommended to me was a book called La Mulata, The Tal, by Miguel Asturias. And it's really weird. Asturias has been sort of lost to time. However, both Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Borges cited Asturias as the sort of the grandfather of magical realism. They both said that they're very heavily influenced by him. He won the Nobel Prize in 1969, and yet I hadn't heard of him. Most people haven't. It's this odd sort of literary mystery that more people haven't heard of him. I think a lot of magical realist scholars don't give him the credit he should receive. Anyway, she signs this book to me, and the book is so bizarre and so strange, I felt like I was losing my mind trying to read this book. You know, by the end of the first chapter, which might have been 30 pages long at most, I couldn't tell which end was up. I didn't know what was going on. I felt like the literal walls in my apartment were moving. This book is so intensely weird. And so that experience always stuck with me, you know, obviously. And so when I started writing this, I, you know, I'm not out to drive anybody crazy, but I was like, I don't have to be tethered to the world in the way, you know, some other authors seem to feel they have to be. I can, you know, let that go and see what happens. And so then, yeah, I started writing this and I started thinking about, you know, the sort of, if you're writing something that may be semi-autobiographical, you know, there's a person that actually went through the event. There's a person who is writing about what the first person went through. And then, you know, there's some situation later on where the person is recounting what they've written about what they went through. So you know, we all go through these different stages. I'm just collapsing them a little bit.
What's the range of feedback then like?
Generally, the reaction is very positive. You know, when I first wrote it, the reaction was positive, but I personally thought it was so weird that nobody would ever publish it. So I actually just sort of put it away for years and didn't think about it. And then, you know, recently I saw it again. I was like, yeah, that's not so weird. And so that's when I sent it to Temenos. And I want to thank the editors at Temenos Journal for publishing it. But yeah, the reaction has been very positive. There have been a few people who've said, I had to read it a couple of times to sort of follow along and know where everything was going. But fortunately, it's very short as well. So it's easy to read a few times.
There is a meta aspect to it, you know, literally and kind of and figuratively. The poem at the heart of the story, it's like a meta poem because it's a poem about poetry and poets writing poetry. It's like an enigma wrapped in a, what is that silly expression? I mean, it really is. There are so many layers to this, but that is kind of like the linchpin in the whole thing. But then there's the meta aspect. You know, you are a Raphael Johnson. Now the character, you know, goes by Andy Johnson, and that's the name of the character in the story. So did you have fun with that whole idea of using your own name? And this is clearly not about you. It's you are writing a piece of fiction. You know, you borrowed probably some things from your own life to write the story.
Sure.
That happens fairly often where authors will have characters that have their names.
Yeah.
And of course that presents kind of a challenge for the reader because it's like right off the bat, you're thinking, well, is this autobiography? And you have to kind of shift and adjust and, you know, figure out what the reality of the story is and why did the author choose to use his own name? So why did you choose to use your own name?
Well, so when I first wrote this story, there's a tradition, a little tradition we had in my creative writing program. Since we're all too broke to buy each other things for our birthdays and such, we would write each other poems and stories and sort of, you know, present them to each other. So this was written to my friend, Brian Morrison, who is quite real and is, you know, as I say, he is, if I say Brian Morrison, he's here. If you say Brian Morrison, he's there. I don't know how that works, but that's how he is. And, you know, when I was thinking about, you know, who is telling the story and how is this being conveyed? Skipping ahead a little bit. With my novel, The Through. The Through is about this estranged couple in Alabama. The guy's named Ben. The woman is named Adrian. Their relationship is coming apart. And they discover a slave ship floating in the sky above their heads. And they have to figure out what to do about this thing. When people read the book, especially people they know me, the question I get most often is, are you Ben? Is that you in this book? And what I say to that is, yes, I'm Ben, but I'm also Adrian. I'm also the ship. I'm also the cat. I'm everything in this book. And when I write a novel, I am trying to present all of these aspects of myself and really explore them and understand them. So it is an exploration of the self. And so I would say in Morrison's note, in using my own name, one, I'm kind of defeating that urge for people to ask me, am I in the story or is this autobiographical? Because I am telling you straight up, it's not autobiographical, but I'm inviting the question by having multiple characters with my name in it. But I'm also, you know, having that exploration of the self, that there are multiple me's, you know, running around the universe at any one time, some in the past, some in the present, some in the future, some living in my stories, you know, being read by people I've never met, some on old podcasts and interviews. You know, there are lots of me's at any given time. And so I started thinking, well, what would it be like to bring some of them, not all of them, because that would be confusing, but a few of them together in a specific, you know, container we can call a short story. And, you know, how would they interact? What would they do? In this case, they didn't really care much for each other. That's fine.
Conceptually, it's unique. And then you have a very unique way of using language, which I find the most compelling. You know, I love the the imaginative use of form, but then the language, you just have this way of finding things and linking things, images. It's the kind of thing that defies description. People just have to read it or hear it being read to really understand what I'm talking about. But I think you know what I'm referring to in these stories. When you started writing, who were your influences? What kind of reading did you do in the way of fiction?
When I started writing, I actually did not read a lot of, certainly not a lot of fiction at the time, and almost no literary fiction at the time. If I read at all, it was probably genre fiction, probably fantasy, high fantasy, science fiction, something like that. And I just want to state right now that if anybody's listening to me and think that they can't read that or shouldn't read that because they want to be an author, that is false. Read whatever floats your boat. Read whatever helps you out.
That's great.
But no, at the time, I wanted to be a filmmaker, actually, when I started. And I had made a short film, and I had ideas for some others, and I couldn't decide. So back then, I think I had like 7 or 8 ideas of like the next short film I would make. And so I just started writing out my ideas, you know, trying to flesh them out. And I started showing them to a friend of mine. And my friend was like, you know, you could just publish these as is without making the movie. And I was like, really? That would be a lot easier and cheaper than what I'm doing.
You are a very practical minded person. Yeah, I can tell.
And so from that, I started looking around for, you know, authors like me, like, you know, African-American male authors, you know, writing these sort of odd and unique stories. And I found at the time next to nothing. You know, now that I've been in the writing world, in the literary world for a while, I know about a lot more writers who are like me, like Victor Laval, Colson Whitehead, Edward P. Jones, and so on. But at the time, I hadn't heard of any of them. And so I just very much had to start writing the stories that I wanted to see. Like, I was like, if the story that represents me isn't being written, then I need to write it. Now, it turns out that they were being written. I just didn't know who they were, but that's how I got started. I mean, I have some major influences. Toni Morrison, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, I would say are my two of my biggest influences. And there are many more, but in terms of like how I actually put words on a page, you might look at, say, Ishiguro.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Because when I read his work, the sentences are so precise. Mm. It feels like he laid out this gigantic scroll and then took a pair of tweezers and placed every single word exactly where it needs to be. And I can't think of, when I read Ishiguro, I can't think about rearranging any of the sentences, or I would have used this word or that word. So that's what I look for when I'm reading something that really inspires me. You know, the writing should be just so perfect and so beautiful, and every word exactly where it needs to be. There's nothing extra, there's nothing missing. That's the stuff that really sort of pulls me forward. You know, there's also, you might say, certainly not all of Flannery O'Connor, but the beginning of A Good Man Is Hard to Find, that opening paragraph is a good example. I would say it's one of those paragraphs that is like letter perfect. You can't change any word in that paragraph without changing the meaning of the story. And so that's, you know, that's what I try to do.
Your writing, it gives this kind of false impression that it's very free flowing and free form, but it's not. You know, when you really look closely at it, you can see how disciplined you are about putting those words together. I'm not a casual reader, but still, you know, I think it's something that people who are into literature are going to see and understand and appreciate.
Okay,
and that kind of leads me to a couple of these other stories that I'd like to talk about. Belle and Cut Mary Somewhere in the Sugarcane is something that is so different from Morrison's Note. You read one story by an author, and especially if it's something like Morrison's Note, you're curious about what you might find with the next one, right? You know, is it going to be more towards the realism end of the spectrum or further the other way? You know, so this was like kind of in the middle, but there are so many aspects to this that raise this to a very unique level as far as literature is concerned, you know, from the way I see it.
Yeah, Bell and Cut Mary Somewhere in the Sugar Cane. That came from a lot of places.
Mm.
So in that one, I use a choral narrator. So there are multiple people shaping the story as we read it. They're arguing with each other. They're interrupting each other. Sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't. But it's all of them together that form the narrative. There's no one person or one entity in charge. And so for me, it's very much like when I was a young child visiting my relatives in Arkansas, and there'd be, you know, 20 adults around the table and kids playing, you know, matchbox cars under the table or whatever. Listening to a story like that, you know, when the adults have forgotten you're there and everybody's talking. And yes, there's one story emerging, but, you know, there's no, it's not like there's one voice and everyone else is silent. Everyone's sort of pushing on this narrative. And I was thinking about that a lot at the time I wrote that. And I still think about it a lot. And so I wanted to shape something like that. And yeah, so that's how that story started to emerge.
You had spoken earlier about magical realism, and clearly this falls into that category as far as I can see. How would you, if you had to pick one of those speculative fiction, the subcategories, where would you be able to put it in one of those or not?
And there's sort of the outer and the inner, you know, outer, like if we need to put tags on a podcast or a blog post, magical realism works fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a way of letting other people know that if they like something else that was classified like that, they will also like my writing.
Yes.
But for me and for the people that experience life in this way, this is just how we experience life. I grew up with multiple people shaping stories and hearing about supernatural events or what seems to be supernatural events was a natural part of my day. It's not that there is this realism and then I go around the corner and something weird happens and then I go back to this supposed shared realism that we all have. All of these things happen together for me and for millions of people around the world. You know, that's part of the power of someone like, let's say, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, when he talks about the most fantastic, wonderful events in the most day-to-day tone of voice, you know, because these are regular things in the life of the people in Macondo or in some of his other books. These are just things that happen.
Hmm.
And so, you know, for this story, you know, I think the tone is a bit more elevated than that, but I would have a hard time drawing a distinction between the sort of day-to-day reality where if we look around right now, Russia is invading Ukraine. The Supreme Court is trying to pull us backwards in time. You know, all of these bizarre events are going on. And so it's hard for me to say, oh, well, this thing here is reality. This other thing here is fantasy. And I know which is which. I don't think, you know, that was always a false dichotomy.
Mm-hmm.
For me as a writer, I don't think of myself as writing magical realism or speculative fiction necessarily. When I'm writing, I just look at the character and I say, okay, what happened next? And what happened next? And what happened next?
Mm-hmm.
And wherever that goes is where it goes.
Yeah, you know, that kind of fits in with the whole oral history aspect of this story, which you reflected upon with, you know, your childhood experiences with your family, because clearly, you know, this is a piece of oral history, but, you know, the speakers are not your typical, you know, oral history speakers. There are odd things that happen in this story. Is it a spoiler to say that one character has a flower growing out of his hand?
No, not at all. You know, again, when I write, I try to ask the characters, like, okay, what happened to you next? And, you know, if they are telling me what's going on and I'm really in a good space to receive that, that's where my best work comes from. Mm. If I'm sitting there, like, quote unquote, making things up and just trying to force the story, I never, ever release any of that stuff. Mm. It's not any good. So in this case, these different narrators have a lot on their minds, and they have different competing concerns. One is very religious. Others are not. Some are gossipy. Some don't want to talk about it and feel kind of dragged into the conversation. But certainly they are quite aware of, you know, I mean, the story is in many ways about the environment and the effects yes. that, you know, the interaction between humans and environment. And so they are intimately aware of that. And also, I would want to say that, you know, you're saying these weren't typical oral history speakers. And in a way, they're not, because, you know, they're a bit ethereal. They're a bit odd. But for me, yes. again, this is how I received oral history. This sound and that feeling and that story is very much me under the dining room table, you know, listening in on a story I probably shouldn't have heard about, something they would not have spoken about if they had remembered I was in the room. It is definitely that feeling.
Yeah, I think it's clear that that's what those voices are rooted in. But then your skills as a writer and your imagination come to bear, and those voices become, as you refer to them as ethereal, they are otherworldly. And yeah. this yeah. is the work of a skilled writer who has taken those oral history, you know, the voices of your own ancestors, and woven them into the fabric of this story in a way that raises everything to a level of art. This story, the one of the other things about it is the dialect that you've written it in, mm-hmm. which is a challenge for a reader. And it made me think about getting a work like this published in a journal, mm-hmm. because this obviously is not going to be for every journal. Did you have any experience with submitting this that you can talk about in terms of, you know, an unusual response or a surprise, yeah. you know, something that surprised you?
Hmm. Well, I think first I would say, you know, while thank you for, you know, your comment about how I'm elevating, you know, this sort of thing to art. But again, I would say I think about it differently. I think it's already art.
Yes. Your points are so, so meaningful. And I appreciate that. So I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
No. Yeah. I think of it, you know, we read stories about heroes, about people who succeed against all odds and, you know, do all these great things. But I am just as interested in the people that don't succeed. I'm just as interested in the people who don't make it, who don't triumph. I think their stories are just as valid as the heroes we tend to valorize. And so for me, that is already art. And so when I'm writing, I am trying to not just privilege the stories of the heroes, but also the stories of the almost heroes and the failures and the could have beens and, you know, all those people that make up a community or a society, you know. They don't all succeed. In fact, you know, depending on the time and place, you could say most of them don't succeed. But that is still worthy of being included in literature. Mm. And so, yeah, when I think about, you know, these characters I'm writing, I'm just as interested in them as anyone else. And for the dialect, okay. So, I mean, there are a lot of things going on with that. I would say the first thing is that when people try to write Southern dialects, they tend to rely on television or movie depictions of Southern dialects, and then they try to transliterate those into literature. And I never find that very successful. They also tend to, because there are a multitude of Southern dialects, and, you know, there's like the dialect of, I had an elderly neighbor in Austin who spoke almost like a machine gun. I mean, it was like this very fast, like rat-a-tat cadence. And, you know, I have cousins from Southern Arkansas who speak incredibly slowly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know people in New Orleans who have this musical lilt, and, you know, just people in Florida and North Carolina, just on and on. There's just this multitude of dialects. And so When I was putting this dialect together, I decided that instead of trying to represent just the dialects I knew personally, I wanted to sort of craft my own in a way that would give me like maximum flexibility with what I wanted to say. So I wouldn't be bound by the rules and the word choice of any one particular part of the South. So something that evoked the South, but is not from any one particular place. So then the next thing I started thinking about was, it was word order and word choice. And I started thinking about these people and I thought, okay, they're really, I just decided that they were very practical, very hardworking, or had been very hardworking, probably in agriculture or mining or timber or something very hard for quite a bit of their lives. And so they would not waste time on words that were nice for a sentence, words that help white people understand the meaning. They got right to the meat of what they wanted to say and they skipped the rest. So I started taking out adverbs and conjunctions and articles and just anything that they might consider fluff. And once I started doing that, and once I started prioritizing their word order based on the things they needed to get out of their mouths before somebody interrupted them, then that dialect started to emerge as a thing of its own, and it became a thing I could shape.
Were you ever concerned at any point that from a practical standpoint, and again, this kind of goes against everything you've said today so far about how you approach your art, but I'm just curious. I always want to ask these kind of questions. Did you ever think about that possibly posing a problem, creating an obstacle when you're trying to get this published?
People
might have a problem, you know, getting into the story, because sometimes dialects can be tricky and they can people can be put off by them right at the outset, and then you've lost the reader. You're hoping that a publisher and, you know, an editor at a highly respected publication is going to be approaching the work a little differently. Yeah. So, but yeah, you never know, you know.
Yeah, and I have to thank the editors at African American Review for taking a chance on this wild story. When I first drafted it, I also pulled out all punctuation because we don't use periods in real life. We don't use commas in real life, you know? And again, and thinking about like their need to sort of argue their part before somebody else came in, I was like, they probably never actually get to the period. You know, how often do they actually get to the end of their sentence? But then a very interesting thing happened. When I removed the periods, I realized that a lot of the sentences I wrote at the time didn't actually end. The sentences only stopped because I got to a point where I didn't know what else to say, so I put a period there. And I realized that my sentences weren't actually coming to any sort of conclusion. They were just stopping. And it was a very artificial stop. And so that's when I started really thinking much harder about precision and clarity and bringing every sentence to a natural conclusion. And so that Bell and Cut Mary Somewhere in the Sugar Cane is my first real attempt at making sure every sentence is almost a world unto itself, and that it has its own beginning, middle, and end. And if you took out the punctuation, the sentence would function in the exact same way. If there's a pause, I try to have a pause in the sentence because speaking those words aloud would make you change your embouchure, take a breath. Like, there has to be a natural reason to pause there. And if that's not happening, then if someone is speaking rapidly, you know, nowhere in the story do I write, "And she said rapidly, da 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 da." Like, these have to be words that can be said quickly.
Right.
They have to be words that are naturally like that. So that's when I really started operating on that level.
Were you ever asked to read that story, like at an author reading?
Oh yeah, I've done it many times.
I'd love to hear that, especially now that I know that you're an actor, that you have acting experience. I really want to hear that. Speaking about this, you know, the structurally those sentences and removing the punctuation, that's making me want to talk about The Boy Who Climbed His Mother into Heaven, because you kind of take that and you kind of run in the opposite direction with it. Yeah. And you, and it's basically like a couple of real insane run-on sentences.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it
and it's like a fever dream. And it's the kind of thing as you're reading it, it's like you're on a roller coaster and it's like you're out of breath when you reach the end of that story.
So with that story, that came from my experience as an aid worker in Liberia. And there was an incident where a very disheveled man knocked another man off a motorcycle. And, you know, the guy gets up and he's very angry. And then sort of the whole town gathers around him and they're like, nope, leave this guy alone. Don't try to do anything. And it turned out that he was a former child soldier who had committed such atrocities during their civil wars that he had gone insane. He had stopped speaking, so nobody knew what part of the country he was from, what language he spoke, or no one knew his name either. They just called him the crazy guy. And so I would, in the town where I lived, I would see this guy wandering up and down the streets, stealing stuff, passing out under a tree or whatever. And, you know, no one knew how to try to reach him and, you know, maybe give him some help. And also, he's incredibly violent. Also, you know, he would disembowel somebody without thinking about it. And so the best thing to do was to leave him alone. And mm-hmm. so then I thought, well, how do we reclaim this person? How do we keep him in the family of humanity? And I know he did horrible, horrific things. And yet there is somewhere in there is a little kid mm-hmm. who was pressed into a war, not of his making, when he was 6 or 7 years old. And how, even if we can't communicate with him, even if we never are able to get him help, how do we tell that story? And I started thinking about that, and that's where that story came from. So obviously, I never spoke to him. I had very little interaction with him except to see him on the street. But I started thinking about, in this case, I actually did think about form because he would wander up and down the street sort of relentlessly. And then I was like, okay, what is the narrative that motivates that sort of movement? You're walking up the hill, you're walking down the hill. You're walking up the hill, you're walking down the hill. What drives him up the hill? What drives him back down the hill? And so then I started thinking about these, since he never spoke, I started thinking, well, what if there's just this long, unbroken narrative that never stopped? You know, if that trauma never lets him rest, never lets him catch a breath, never lets him sleep, never gives him a moment's peace. He can't stop it. He can't turn it off. So that's where that started to emerge. Now, I did have to break it into three sentences.
Wow. What a challenge that must
have been. It was quite a challenge.
Where do I put the period here?
Yeah, no, technically it was quite a challenge.
I was wondering as I was reading it, am I going to get to the end of the story and never see a period until the last line? Yeah. here's one.
It does happen, but yeah, it was quite a challenge, and it took me a while to sort of put all of it together. And, you know, in that case, there are plenty of commas, for example.
Yeah.
But that felt right in this case, as opposed to Bell and Cut Mary, because his natural narrative was interrupted by an outside force.
Mm.
You know, it is sort of punchy and starting and stopping and, you know, all these sort of discombobulated thoughts all rushing at the same time. So in that case, you know, it felt right. It felt okay.
In each story, you've made a choice, a stylistic choice, that's so bold, and yet it fits the content of the story, the people, you know, the meaning behind what's occurring in the story. You know, it fits them to a T in each case. It couldn't come easily to a writer, I would think. Yet it sounds like it did come easily to you.
I think the ideas come. I have plenty of ideas, but... you know, getting, again, it's that thing where I ask the characters, okay, what happened next? Like, what really happened? And representing that just right on the page, it takes work. Yeah, I mean, it takes, you know, for every word I publish, there's easily a, you know, 100 or 1,000 that I don't. With my current work in progress, which is a sequel to The Through, I had a draft that was about 140,000 words. Last week, I cut that down to 26,000. And those other 100-something thousand words are, you know, will probably never see the light of day. Or, you know, I might shape a little bit of it into a short story if it really sort of falls out of this narrative entirely. But yeah, there's a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of really beautiful sentences I've written that just didn't fit anything. And so, there's a lot of that.
You are obviously someone who, at the beginning of the process, kind of surrenders to the process in a way that I don't hear a lot of other authors talking about. It's like almost like a spiritual thing where there's something kind of moving through you. And mm-hmm. when you talk about the characters telling you where things are going to go, that is not an unusual thing to hear. That's a fairly common thing for writers to talk about, the characters telling them, you know, how the story is going to go. But in your case, it just feels a bit different in that there's even more of a kind of surrendering to this, like trusting that there's going to be something, an impulse there that you're going to get, and you're just going to go with the impulse, and then the impulse is going to bring you somewhere, take you somewhere.
Yeah. And I think as a writer, a lot of our challenge is to trust that impulse and to release our egos and sort of release our need to be seen and to be published and to win awards and fellowships and everything, and just sort of let it happen. And, you know, when I can completely do that, that's when I feel I write my best work. And when I don't, when I'm fighting and struggling and everything else, then, you know, not as much.
And I think you've just kind of described what separates really great work from good work, average work. It's having come from that place where you've just kind of gotten out of your own way, basically, you know, because that's part of the biggest problem as an artist that I experience. You know, we all get in our own way. We overthink things, but that takes some practice and in self-discipline to get out of learn to get out of your own way. Tell us about, is it a mentorship that you're working on?
Yes. So the Loft Literary Center here in Minneapolis sponsors a mentorship for 12 up-and-coming writers every year. And this year, I'm one of the fiction mentors. And so Minnesota writers, if you've published one book or no books, mm-hmm. and you want to work with some really amazing authors, you should apply to be part of this program. Don't believe it costs anything. This is craft talks. It's direct work on your manuscript, professional development. Like, it's a really fantastic program.
If they looked it up on Google, it would be Loft.
Loft Literary Mentor Series.
All right. Well, that is something that I hope people take advantage of. You've brought so many wise things to this conversation, and so many things I know the listeners are going to take away. They're going to be shaking their heads going, oh my goodness, you are a remarkable person, Andy. And I feel so lucky to have somehow found your path and crossed it and be sitting across from you here today. So thank you so much.
Thank you for
joining me today. This was just pure pleasure for me.
For more information about Andy's consulting company, Inspire to Change, go to inspiretochange.org. That's inspiretochange.org. You can find Andy as A. Raphael Johnson on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And now we'll move on to the short story, Morrison's Note. This was initially published in Temenos Journal. Please note that there are a couple of instances of profanity in the story. So here it is, Morrison's Note by A. Raphael Johnson. This story concerns a man named Andy Johnson, not the Andy Johnson writing the story, nor the Andy Johnson relating the story at a later date. Months, weeks, days, several seconds after a curious set of events altered the life of all Andys Johnson and another man named Brian Morrison, who is here right now hearing the story as you are, and has the ability to always be Brian Morrison at all times and in all places, a quality I lack. A few months ago, Andy Johnson returned from foreign places and found his decrepit rental house had been whisked away to the land of Oz. A shapely and naked female ghost occupied the bedroom on cold nights. Andy Johnson refused to pay extra for the ghost, and the ghost refused to sleep with him. Détente.
Now the house was gone, and Andy found no trace of his night caller. He answered a Craigslist ad placed by a man looking for a roommate. This does not concern the story of the note Andy Johnson would read later, except that Craig, not his real name, threw orgies in the living room for weeks until Andy moved out. However, Andy Johnson writes serious literature, not smut. So if you've come for some racy tale about erect men wrestling in peanut butter, I must disappoint you with this story about his new apartment with a secret compartment in the northeast corner of the living room wall opposite the bathroom. In the Morrison Apartments, formerly the Morrison Mansion, 1609 University Boulevard, second floor, apartment C, accidentally discovered by Andy Johnson on November 11, 2011 at 11:11 p.m. Andy Johnson suffers from a rare illness called Nakafo. In the language of the Vai people of Liberia, Nakafo means blinded eye. Any competent witch doctor will send Nakafo to your enemy with a fee of $300 and a photo of the target. The doctor writes your intended's name upon a corn leaf, then burns the leaf and photo under the eaves of the target's home. This requirement baffled Liberian experts until Andy Johnson revealed that he left America with no intention of returning. "Ah," they said, "you made a home here. This is where your trouble started." Nakafo, they explained, was a prank, a joke, a spiritual banana peel. Schrodinger's cat pelted with a water balloon. Uncomfortable, but harmless. Nakafo exacted small revenge on cheating lovers or bad employers. The symptoms, too heinous to list, invariably drove the sufferer to the same doctor who inflicted the curse in the first place. But Andy Johnson, an outsider, homeless, knew nothing and didn't treat the symptoms in time. Therefore, the disease grew until he went blind. Nakafo is not a physical blindness. Andy Johnson still sees as well or as poorly with his eyes as he ever did. But the Nakafo caged his soul, his spirit, his aura, his je ne sais quoi, and by the very nature of the disease, his soul can no longer detect the unseen chains that restrict him. A spiritual solitary confinement without judge, jury, or jailer, no hope of parole, and no conjugal visits. This is not a story about that Andy Johnson. That Andy Johnson is uninvolved in this story altogether, except for a trifling coincidence. He found the note. In 1873, on what is now University Boulevard, Brian Morrison built the Morrison Mansion to hide his secrets. As I said, Brian Morrison is always Brian Morrison. By invoking his name, he is here. But if someone else invokes his name at the same time in another place, Brian Morrison is also there. I don't know how this works. Don't ask. In the same year that Brian Morrison placed a note inside the Morrison Mansion, Congress enacted the Comstock Law, which outlawed sending any lewd or lascivious items through the mail. Slaves were finally emancipated in Puerto Rico. Jesse James robbed his first train, Heineken brewed his first beer, Henry Rose invented barbed wire, Livingston died. Each wall of his mansion hid a secret compartment, which housed items Morrison knew he would need later. Thumbtacks, a photograph of the devil, Jacob's ladder, a matador's cape, a guitar with the initials N.T. scratched into the frets, which Morrison swore sounded sweeter than all the peaches on earth. A woman's blue suit, tomatoes still growing in a mason jar, and a small barrel of tequila, a scythe, a pelican's beak, an umbrella that dripped water onto anyone under it, rain or shine, table 3 of a Mexican lottery card, a silver pair. Andy Johnson, blind in his way and smelling of peanuts, stumbled into his new apartment over a century later at the once imposing Morrison Mansion, recently cut into inefficient apartments by a distant cousin. He kicked a false panel in the floorboard. Andy Johnson said, "Ow," and "Fuck," and "I broke my toe," and other dreadful things. Andy Johnson is vulgar and coarse, his utterings unimportant, his actions inconsequential. May I remind you that the Andy Johnson in this story is a cipher and should in no way be inferred to be the Andy Johnson who wrote the story, nor the Andy Johnson telling the story now. To even hint at such a thing would constitute libel.
I cannot be responsible. But as the saying goes, even a broken clock is right twice a day. Andy Johnson owned no clock. The false floorboard revealed a hollow behind his living room wall, 6 inches long by 6 inches wide by 12 inches deep. Andy Johnson largely ignored the hole in his wall. This was a symptom of the knockaphobe. Andy Johnson only saw a broken thing he must fix. Blindness prevented him from imagining the hole as an escape from his invisible prison. "Ha!" cried a far-flung, long-lost, half-remembered, great to the nth degree granddaughter of Medusa, who sold hexes in the markets to support an alcoholic husband who couldn't stand the sight of her. "It's working!" Andy Johnson unpacked nails. He was the type of man to pack nails. This should tell you everything you need to know, and a hammer inscribed with a Mark Twain quote about the world looking like a nail. He no longer understood Mark Twain, although he often visited a Mark Twain impersonator who operated a toy store in a yellow brick building named for a Klansman. Andy Johnson pulled the false panel from the floorboard, fully exposing the hole. A piece of paper fell to the floor. Andy Johnson set it aside to complete his repair. "When I am done," Andy Johnson thought, "this hole will look as good as new." The hole never looked good as new, but I cannot fault Andy Johnson for that. Events overtook him. He glanced at the note. The paper was old and yellowed, lined as if it came from an ordinary school notebook, but the script was florid. A fountain pen, perhaps even a quill pen, wrote, "From Brian Morrison to Brian Morrison, care of Andy Johnson." Andy Johnson opened the envelope. The temperature dropped. Andy Johnson found a note that read in part, "I have been seeking the perfect poem for my entire life. It occurred to me that by living as myself at all times, in all times, I might find it. I did, and wrote the poem here. Please, please deliver the poem to me tomorrow. In faith, Brian Morrison." Andy was furious. Who in the hell was Brian Morrison to leave notes? As if people needed perfect poems. Did perfect poems exist? Even if they did, who cares? Who would read them? Would a poem feed a starving child or dig a well in Africa? Would a stupid fucking poem cure cancer? Clear rubble after an earthquake? Andy Johnson thought, "I live in the real world, and prosody never paid the piper." Andy flipped the page angrily, furiously, and saw Brian's poem. The poem concerned a poem, itself about another poem where the poet had read all the poems ever written. The poem represented every poem at once, in every language, throughout time. It was short. There was a dog and a plant and a young child. Once when Andy was small, he had stolen his mother's bicycle and pushed it to the top of a large hill. On the way down, just before he crashed, Andy felt as if his body no longer moved, but the world spun suspended beneath him like a child's yo-yo. This was that feeling. No, the placement of the words carried the meaning. No, something about an idea and a dog. He read that part again. He laughed. He ran outside, cheering. He chased a jogger down University Boulevard, shouting, "Look, the poem! You have to look!" The knockaphobe possessed him utterly. Andy ran into a bar and ordered drinks for everyone, including the cops who tried to arrest him. Locked handcuffs fell from his wrists. Pepper spray made his skin glisten. The officers threw Andy in the back of a squad car and drove away. But when they looked in the rearview mirror, they saw Andy sitting in the middle of the street. One of the officers, himself a transplant from foreign places, said, "It won't be long now." Andy ran back to the Morrison apartments, heaving, panting, crying, and found he had been evicted. Locked doors meant no more to him than handcuffs. His apartment was empty save for the hammer and nails. He read the inscription. He got it. Andy crawled into the small hole in the floorboard with the poem and nailed it shut from the inside, cackling, "I've won! I've won!" Andy Johnson left behind no artifacts, no cryptic messages, no hints of where he truly went nor what he planned to do.
So I must conclude that Andy Johnson, the writer, invented this story out of whole cloth. I find no evidence to support his tale. I would ask Brian Morrison, but he is notoriously unreliable. I can only report what I observe with my own eyes. On cold nights, a voluptuous ghost climbs the stairs at the Morrison apartments, knocks on 1609C, waits, then leaves. There is nothing more to see. Thank you, Andy, for allowing us to share that provocative and mysterious story. Well, that's the end of our episode today. Thank you for listening. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Marcela Fuentes. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories are